Let me again express my extreme gratitude for having been invited to speak at Southern. The cultural influence of the English Bible. In my first address in this series, I considered the Bible as it is in itself and as a very literary book. In my second address, I considered the Bible in relation to something that flows from it, namely a Christian aesthetic or a Christian way of thinking about the arts. In my final address, I again want to branch out from the Bible to something that has flowed from it. My subject is the historical influence of the English Bible in the English-speaking world. I'm going to spring a small surprise on you here immediately by asserting that the influence that I will trace is almost solely the influence of the King James Version of the Bible. It is true that a whole century of English Bible translation preceded the King James Version of 1611, but the King James Version was the culmination of all the preceding translations, most noteworthy of which were Tyndale's New Testament of 1526 and the Geneva Bible of 1560. The form in which the English Bible exerted an influence on the English and American nations for four centuries was the King James Version. If it seems a small disappointment to you here at the outset that I will be speaking about the King James Version specifically, I'm glad for the occasion to clarify that it is this specific English Bible that has exerted the influence. My address to you today was originally composed as a tribute to the King James Bible during the anniversary year of its 400th anniversary, which was last year. I chose to retain the phraseology of that address as I explore with you the historical influence of the Bible on English-speaking cultures, and I've done so for the following three reasons. First, it is simply the fact of the matter that the King James Version was the Bible that produced the influence of which I speak, so I want to keep the record accurate. Second, it is appropriate to give honor where honor is due, so I intend to do that for the King James Version. Thirdly, it is important for us at our moment in history to take stock of what we lost when a common English Bible was replaced by the proliferation of English Bible translations that we have today. No modern English Bible translation is exerting any of the cultural influence of which I speak, except for the influence among Christians and in the church. When the King James Bible lost its position of centrality in the English-speaking world, the Bible largely ceased to be a cultural influence. Instead of congratulating ourselves on the number of English Bible translations that are currently available, we need to take stock of what the fallout has been, especially in terms of biblical illiteracy and indifference to what the Bible says, begotten of a skepticism that we can know what the Bible says when there are so many rival translations. As I trace what it was like in English and American cultures when the King James Version was the common English Bible, perhaps it can serve as a wake-up call that leads us to see our current crisis more clearly. As we stand on the verge of my third lecture in this series, allow me to prompt you to think about the interconnections among the three addresses by saying that the King James Version is the most literary English Bible, and that the influence of the Bible on English-speaking cultures would not have been as remarkable as it has been if the King James Version had lacked the literary excellencies that it possesses. As an epigraph for my address, I want to quote the wonderful epithet that was pinned on the Bible in McGuffey's Fifth Eclectic Reader. McGuffey's reader called the Bible the best of classics the world has ever admired. The McGuffey's Reader series is itself an example of the historical influence of the Bible, inasmuch as it incorporates many passages from the Bible. It is beyond question that the King James Version of the Bible is the most influential book in the history of the English-speaking world. From approximately 1660 to 1950, the King James Bible was the preeminent book in England and America in virtually every sphere of society that we can name: religion, family, church, politics, education, literature, art, and music. For nearly four centuries, the King James Bible formed what in literary and other academic circles is called the mythological universe of English-speaking cultures. To explain that concept, I can do no better than quote from former Yale University professor George Lindbeck. Here's how Lindbeck describes the role that the English Bible played in English and American cultures across the decades of its dominance. I quote, "Until recently, most people in traditionally Christian countries lived in the linguistic and imaginative world of the Bible. It was not the only world in which they dwelt, yet the text above all texts was the Bible. Its stories, images, conceptual patterns, and turns of phrase permeated the culture from top to bottom. This was true even for illiterates and those who did not go to church, for knowledge of the Bible was transmitted not only directly by its reading, hearing, and ritual enactment, but also indirectly by an interwoven net of intellectual, literary, artistic, folkloric, and proverbial traditions. There was a time when every educated person, no matter how professedly unbelieving or secular, knew the actual text from Genesis to Revelation. The Bible came to supply the conceptual and imaginative vocabularies with which we construe and construct reality. So pervasive is this scriptural idiom that much of Western literature consists of subtexts of the biblical text. Thus, all of experience, including sacred texts from other religions, such as the classics of Greece and Rome, was absorbed into the scriptural framework. The punchline, Christendom dwelt imaginatively in the biblical world. The main point of the address from which I have quoted is that the English-speaking world has become biblically illiterate. And I will just note with alarm Lynn Beck's claim that, quote, when I first arrived at Yale, even those who came from non-religious backgrounds knew the Bible better than most of those now who come from church-going families. The onset of biblical illiteracy in English-speaking cultures began with the loss of a common Bible, which the King James Version had been for 3.5 centuries, and additionally with the loss of the kind of Bible the King James Version is. For the remainder of this address, I will provide a wide-angle picture of how broadly the King James Bible permeated English and American cultures. Choosing a place to start is arbitrary, so I decided to start at a place that I found particularly interesting when I conducted the research for my book on the King James Bible. As I communed with myself, to use a King James phrase, it occurred to me that one evidence of the cultural presence of the King James Bible through the years is public inscriptions of texts from the King James Version. So let me conduct a brief excursion with you on what public inscriptions tell us about the historical influence of the King James Version of the Bible. If you pass through the college gate of Harvard University, you will read, "Open ye the gates, that the righteous nation which keepeth the truth may enter in." This is Isaiah 26, verse 2, straight from the King James Version. During my graduate school years at the University of Oregon, every time I entered the library, I could look up and read the following engraving. University of Oregon, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." John 8, verse 32, KJV. While the King James Bible made it onto these public inscriptions in the first place because of its cultural dominance, once the inscriptions were in place, they kept the King James Bible continuously alive in people's sight and awareness. The King James Version is alive and well at the United Nations headquarters in New York City. The most celebrated instance can be found across the street from the main building. The space is called the Isaiah Wall, and it contains these words from Isaiah 2, verse 4. "They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore." The same verse is inscribed on the base of a statue that stands on the actual grounds of the United States nation's headquarters. The original world-changing Cavendish Laboratory of Cambridge University in England bore Psalm 111, verse 2 in Latin over the archway. But after the laboratory moved to its new site, the inscription appears over the archway in its King James form. "The works of the Lord are great, sought out of all them that have pleasure therein." Every year, 2 million visitors to the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia can read Leviticus 25, verse 10 in its King James form. "Proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof." We have all seen Bible verses on the walls of churches, a custom that goes back in England at least to the 16th century. You would be hard-pressed to find a church or cathedral where the texts are not from the King James Version. Even the imposing tablets of the word that adorn the walls of Coventry Cathedral, dedicated in 1956, are inscribed from the King James Version. Each of these 8 huge inscriptions consists of a statement that Jesus made about himself, and every time a visitor or worshiper looks at an inscription, the King James Version lives on, as in the verse, "For the Son of Man is come to seek and to save that which was lost." Through the years, a gold-gilt Bible verse has been posted on the front wall of the suburban St. Louis Church where I was married. It reads, For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. As I look up from a pew of 10th Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia, I can see the following verses on memorial plaques on the walls, all from the KJV. He being dead yet speaketh, being made conformable unto his death. Well done, thou good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. A stroll through the Iowa cemetery where my family members and acquaintances lie buried is a trip through famous King James resurrection verses. The Lord is my light and my salvation. I am the resurrection and the life. Blessed are the dead which die in the Lord, that they may rest from their labors and their works do follow them. I know that my Redeemer liveth. When the inscriptions that I have quoted were engraved and posted, the King James Version was the only major English Bible that existed. When people in the English-speaking world spoke of the Bible, they meant the King James Version. I will conclude with some specimens of the King James verses that appear on the walls of the Dunham Bible Museum on the campus of Houston Baptist University. These verses contain statements uttered by famous people on landmark occasions in American history as follows. Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Benjamin Franklin, during a debate at the drafting of the United States Constitution, with the words coming from Psalm 127, verse 1. What hath God wrought? Samuel Morse, sending the first words over his newly invented telegraph machine, with the words coming from Numbers 23, verse 23. When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, astronaut Buzz Aldrin on a television broadcast from space after his 1969 spacewalk, with the words coming from Psalm 8, verse 3. A house divided against itself cannot stand. Abraham Lincoln in his acceptance speech for candidacy to the United States Senate, with the words coming from Mark 3, verse 25. The public inscriptions that I have surveyed already show the range of cultural influence of the King James Version, from universities to a world-famous science laboratory, to churches and cathedrals, to political speeches, to burial places, to public broadcasts. With my entry into the subject now complete, I want to proceed more systematically through the leading cultural spheres in which the King James Bible has been the most important book and the central element of cultural cohesion in English-speaking cultures over a span of 3.5 centuries. It is customary to start with the influence of the King James Bible on the English language, but I have chosen instead to end there. It is hard to prove the influence of the King James Version on the English language. But by the time I survey the dominance of the King James Bible across the spectrum of cultural spheres, it will seem self-evident that the King James Version has exercised the influence on the English language that scholars claim. So I will start with a subject for which we have hard data, namely the supremacy of the King James Version in the field of book publishing. Sources claiming that the King James Version is the best-selling book of all time are too numerous to cite. According to Adam Nicholson, author of the book God's Secretaries, The Making of the King James Bible, more than 5 billion copies of the King James Bible have been sold. David Daniel, in his magisterial book The Bible in English, believes that the King James Version is still the best-selling book in the world. Multiple sources claim that the King James Bible is the most frequently quoted book in existence. The author of the book, The Story of English, calls the King James Version the single most influential book ever published in the English language, and Bartlett's Bible Quotations agrees. A Rare Book website claims that the King James Bible is the most printed book in the history of the world, and Gordon Campbell believes that the King James Version is the most important book in the English language. I think it obvious that in the history of book publishing, the King James Version is supreme. As I move now to other cultural spheres where the King James Version has been dominant for nearly 4 centuries, I will be giving snapshots or specimens that are parts of an overall picture. The second sphere that I propose to explore is education, and particularly where education starts, namely childhood learning. From the 17th century through the 19th, English and American children learned to read via the Bible, which for the most of that time span meant the King James Bible. Children carried their Bibles to school, and in some eras and places, the King James Bible was either the sole or leading book in the curriculum. When textbooks were available, such as the New England Primer, passages from the King James Bible were interspersed throughout the books. One scholar sums up the situation by saying that it is from the King James Bible that the English-speaking world learned to read and to think. And Robert Stone theorizes that the greatest vehicle of literacy in the English-speaking world has been the King James Bible. It has been the great primer. The secretary of the Wheaton College English Department is a Filipina, and she says regarding her childhood education that, quote, the King James Version of the Bible has been the best English language teacher I ever had. Having cited that anecdote, I want to take another brief excursion down a bypath. The King James Bible is not solely an English and American book. It has been an influence in English-speaking cultures and subcultures around the world. In my 45 years of teaching at Wheaton College, I've witnessed a steady stream of students from non-Western countries, and overwhelmingly, the English Bible of these students has been the King James Version. In my book on the legacy of the King James Bible, I devote paragraphs to the experiences of a music professor at Wheaton College who grew up in South Africa, a music professor at Philadelphia Biblical University who grew up in Hong Kong, and Nigerian author Chinua Achebe, who recounts his upbringing in his autobiographical essay entitled The Education of a British Protected Child, and who quotes from the King James Bible in his novels. David Daniel, in his book The Bible in English, Its History and Influence, tells the story of the influence of the English and American Bible societies, and he entitles the unit that covers this history KJV for the World. Benson Brobrook, in his book Wide as the Waters, The Story of the English Bible and the Revolution It Inspired, writes that, quote, Englishmen carried their Bible with them overseas, even as it came to live in their own language with more abiding force. Its impact on thought and culture eventually spread the world over, as wide as the waters be. And Alistair McGrath, in his equally great book, In the Beginning, The Story of the King James Bible and How It Changed a Nation, a Language, and a Culture, notes that, I quote, the expansion of British economic and military influence in the later 18th and 19th centuries was preceded and accompanied by missionary work based on the King James Bible. Wherever English language versions of Christianity sprang up, these would usually be nourished by this definitive translation. Childhood education has been my second sphere of King James influence, with a side trip through the King James Bible as a non-Western as well as Western influence. Another sphere where the King James Version was the dominant presence for 3.5 centuries was the devotional and church lives of Christians. In fact, it was from this sphere that the influence spread outward into other cultural provinces. I will provide a sketch of how this worked itself out in my own life, and the story that I tell is surely the norm for millions of Protestant families over the course of 4 centuries. I heard the King James Bible read after meals, often 3 times every day, because I grew up on a farm where the father was present for 3 meals. I heard the King James Version read and preached on from the pulpit 2x every Sunday. Passages from the King James Version were printed conspicuously in the Sunday school handout on Sunday mornings. Bible memorization was based on the King James Version at both church and Christian schools. When a representative from the Gideons handed out maroon-colored New Testaments at my grade school, the translation was the King James Version. When I was 9, my parents gave me an inscribed King James Bible as a Christmas gift, and I used it right through my college years. Religious plaques that hung in our home and in neighbors' homes were verses from the King James Version. And if today you go into the guest bathroom in my house, you will see a plaque that I made in the 3rd or 4th grade by gluing the letters of dry alphabet soup onto a piece of pegboard. It reads, "Blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered." Psalm 32, verse 1 from the King James Version. I'll just note in passing that I think the institution of religious plaques on walls kind of ceased when the King James Version also ceased to be the common English Bible. I've already eased my way into a related sphere of influence that I call religious discourse, consisting of sermons, devotional books, and Bible commentaries. From the mid-17th century to the mid-20th century, we can picture virtually all of the famous Christian speakers and religious writers as using the King James Bible. A few random snapshots will suffice to illustrate that claim. As I recently perused a booklet with excerpts from the past on the subject of justification, it was obvious that for several centuries, the King James Version was the common Bible of evangelical Protestantism. Here are the names of the theologians and preachers included in the booklet, accompanied by a specimen biblical quotation for each treatise that was excerpted. being justified freely by his grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, Charles Spurgeon. All the people that heard him and the publicans justified God, Charles Hodge. With the heart man believeth unto righteousness, A.W. Pink. Not by works of righteousness which we have done, but according to his mercy he saved us, Horatius Bonar. There is no peace, saith my God, to the wicked, J.C. Ryle. Just as we usually do not ask what specific English Bible the great English and American literary authors used, it is easy not to ask what English Bible the towering religious figures of the past used. What Bible did Jonathan Edwards use? Edwards' autobiographical work entitled Personal Narrative provides a ready answer. The scattered biblical quotations are from the King James Version. Now unto the King eternal, immortal, invisible, the only wise God, be honor and glory forever and ever. Amen. My soul breaketh for the longing it hath. A man shall be an hiding place from the wind and a covert from the tempest. What about Charles Spurgeon, who preached to thousands upon thousands at the Metropolitan Tabernacle in London? A quick look at Spurgeon's sermons, commentaries on books of the Bible, or devotional books, like Morning and Evening, will answer the question at once. Spurgeon used the King James Bible. He also endorsed it as the best English translation. In 1884, he wrote, "We have had 10,000 messages from God to our soul in the very words of our English King James Version Bible, and we have prayed over and preached about the precepts and promises it enshrines till we feel a vested interest in the volume as it is." And in a famous passage that praised John Bunyan's biblical vocabulary, Spurgeon put in a parenthetical statement about, quote, "our authorized version, which will never be bettered as I judge till Christ come." Beginning in the last quarter of the 20th century, the author of any Bible commentary has clarified in the prefatory part of the book what English translation has been used in the commentary. And in the commentary itself, multiple English versions are likely to be referenced. But for over two centuries, starting around the time of Matthew Henry's commentary, it was so axiomatic that the English translation used in the commentary was the King James Version that one will look in vain for any identification of the English Bible used by the author of the commentary. Billy Graham will provide my final snapshot. One source estimates that Billy Graham has preached to live audiences totaling over 200 million, and some of his individual televised crusades have aired to more than 2 million. His combined lifetime audience, including radio and television broadcasts, has been estimated to be over 2 billion. What English Bible did those listeners hear? Well, they heard the King James Version. I have surveyed spheres of influence that are distinctly religious spheres: education and Bible reading within the home, and religious life in the church. But there are even more non-religious or public spheres, including the following. The courtroom. As I was writing my book on the King James Version, my wife picked up a book at a garage sale entitled Classics of the Bar. Virtually every courtroom speech recorded in this volume contains quotations from the King James Version. For example, Benjamin Tracy, in his concluding speech in the case of Tilton versus Beecher, 1875, quoted Proverbs 11, verse 21. "Though hand join in hand, the wicked shall not be unpunished, but the seed of the righteous shall be delivered." Probably all of you recall how several years ago, in one southern courtroom after another, inscriptions of the Ten Commandments came toppling down as state courts mandated their removal. But the point for us is that for decades, the King James Version had been right there in the legal arena. The removal of engraved inscriptions of the Decalogue has not brought an end to the Bible in the courtroom. A recent article published in the New York City Law Review adduced dozens of examples in proof of the thesis that, quote, "citations from the King James Version of the Bible are numerous in judicial opinions handed down in the court to the present day." Political discourse. The King James Version has been the absolute favorite of British prime ministers and American presidents. Every time they have quoted from the King James Version, it has lived on in the active vocabulary of the populace. Someone has produced a 20-page tabulation of 250 biblical allusions in the writings and papers of George Washington, accompanied by the verse in the King James Bible that most closely corresponds to each one. The survey shows, incidentally, that Washington's favorite biblical image was the vine and fig tree passage found in Micah 4, verse 4. Abraham Lincoln's speeches show a continuous influence of the King James Bible, either by way of stylistic effects or direct quotation. A biographer claims that Lincoln's speeches and public documents were littered with biblical allusions. There's no better illustration than Lincoln's 10-sentence Gettysburg Address. In fact, someone has written a whole book on the indebtedness of Lincoln's most famous address to the King James Bible and Book of Common Prayer. The author finds dozens of biblical echoes in Lincoln's speech and concludes that, quote, what gives Lincoln's language its distinctive flavor is that it is overwhelmingly biblical, with 269 of its 272 words appearing in some form in the King James Version. Even less literary presidents have kept the King James Version alive in public consciousness through the years. In a brief address at the lighting of the Christmas tree on the White House grounds on December 24, 1945, President Truman directly quoted the following verses, "Glory to God in the highest, and on peace, goodwill toward men. A new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore." British Prime Minister Winston Churchill came at the end of the era of the King James Version as the unchallenged English Bible for use in political discourse. Some of Churchill's great speeches of World War II kept the King James Bible alive in his nation's active vocabulary. One of his wartime addresses includes this statement, "At that time I ventured to draw General Waffle's attention to the 7th chapter of the Gospel of St. Matthew at the 7th verse, where, as you all know, or ought to know, it is written, 'Ask, and it shall be given. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you.' As you all know, or ought to know, I cannot think of a better index to the degree to which, for three centuries, most English and American citizens were totally familiar with the King James Version. The most famous referencing of the King James Bible by an orator in modern times is Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, delivered on August 28, 1963, from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. It is easy to surmise from the title by which the speech is known, I Have a Dream, that King intended an allusion to Moses on Mount Pisgah, viewing the Promised Land. Actually, King does not explicitly refer to either Moses or a Promised Land in this speech, although he did so in the speech he delivered the night before his assassination. Nonetheless, the King James Bible lives on in the I Have a Dream speech, partly in the elevated style and affective undertow of the speech, and partly in explicit allusions. Amos 5, verse 24 is present as King declaimed, "We will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream." Isaiah 40, verses 4 and 5 asserts its presence with the statement, "I have a dream that every valley shall be exalted, every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together." Music. Every Christmas season, selections from Handel's oratorio Messiah are performed and listened to all over the English-speaking world. Every time the Messiah is performed, the King James Bible lives on as a cultural influence. In fact, some passages of the King James Bible owe their familiarity more to the Messiah than to the King James Version itself. If you will allow a brief side trip, as the translation committee of the English Standard Version did its work, it quickly evolved a principle that we variously and informally called the King James Principle, the Lord's Prayer Principle, or Handel's Messiah Principle. What this means is that if the passage under consideration is so famous in its King James rendition that it would be self-defeating to change it, it stayed as the King James Version renders it. Almost as famous as Handel's Messiah are the biblical oratorios of Felix Mendelssohn. His oratorio, Elijah, does not follow the King James Version as continuously as Handel's Messiah does, but the King James Bible forms the skeleton on which Mendelssohn built his oratorio. The King James Version is present right from the opening song. "As God the Lord of Israel liveth before whom I stand, there shall not be dew nor rain these years, but according to my word." 1 Kings 17, verse 1. Shortly thereafter, a choral passage closely resembles Exodus 20, verse 5. "For he, the Lord our God, he is a jealous God, and he visiteth all the father's sins on the children to the third and fourth generation of them that hate him." Franz Joseph Haydn's The Creation is also in the tradition of great biblically based oratorios. It is based on the Bible and Milton's epic Paradise Lost. The following famous chorus does not quote verbatim from the King James Version, but it sounds like the King James Version, in which case we are speaking of the King James Version as a stylistic influence and model. "The heavens are telling the glory of God. The firmament displays the wonder of his works." Oratorios, of course, provide the most obvious opportunity for composers to incorporate the actual biblical text into their works, but other musical genres also lend themselves to it. Even among modern choral composers who do not predominantly link their compositions to the English Bible, the King James Bible keeps showing up. We can see this partly in the titles of compositions, with the result that people perusing lists of choral music or programs of concerts will find familiar King James lines kept alive in their active vocabulary. Here's a list of random examples. In the Beginning by Aaron Copland. I Will Lift Up Mine Eyes by John Rutter. Sing Ye to the Lord by Edward Bairstow. Lord, Thou Hast Been Our Refuge, and Oh Clap Your Hands by Ralph Vaughan Williams. If Ye Love Me by Thomas Tallis. God So Loved the World by John Stainer. When we come to hymnody, the picture changes in a direction that is true of literary authors as well. It is this: hymn writers, like poets, refer to the Bible and take the Bible as a source of material, but usually do not quote directly from it. Before we can link their text with the King James Bible, we need to know that they use the King James Version in their daily lives. Once we determine that, however, we have warrant to think of the King James Bible when we read or sing their texts. Isaac Watts is an example. Watts' vocation was that of preacher, and writing hymns was his avocation. A look at Watts' collected sermon shows at once that his English Bible was the King James Version. Watts' tombstone in Bunhill Fields, London, includes as part of its inscription Colossians 3, verse 4, when Christ, who is our life, shall appear, I shall also appear with him in glory. With that as a context, King James associations spring up continuously as we read and sing the hymns that Watts wrote, 750 of them. Watts' hymns stand at varying degrees from the biblical text itself. O God, our help in ages past, stands close to the text of Psalm 90. Lord, Thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations, the psalm begins. O God, our help in ages past, Watts' hymn begins. Our hope for years to come is the second line of Watts' hymn, echoing Psalm 90, verse 14, that we may be glad all our days. Before the mountains were brought forth, verse 2, finds its counterpart in Watts's hymn, before the hills in order stood. And these are only the beginning of parallels. It is hard to imagine what the tradition of English and American sacred music would look like without the King James Bible as a source. A mighty stream has flowed from the King James Version into our musical history. The visual arts. With the visual arts, it is even harder to link individual works with the King James Bible specifically. We have warrant for making the connection, though, if we can find evidence beyond the paintings that an artist's biblical imagination was fed by the King James Version. There are enough examples of this to allow us to make big claims for the influence of the King James Version on English and American painting. I will start with a stellar example, Victorian painter Holman Hunt's famous painting that he titled The Light of the World. There are actually two originals of this painting, the first one hanging in the chapel at Keble College in Oxford, and the second in St. Paul's Cathedral in London. Hunt made the second painting because the first one was ill-kept, hang on to your seats, exposed to leaking pipes at Keble College. The painting pictures Christ standing outside a weed-overgrown door without a handle as the morning star rises behind him, creating a halo effect. Additionally, Christ carries a lantern, which is a second source of light in this nighttime scene. We are not left to guess what English Bible inspired the painting. The inscription is right on the frame. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come in to him and will sup with him and he with me. The title of the painting, The Light of the World, also alludes to Jesus' declaration, I am the light of the world. And in his autobiography, Hunt sometimes links particular biblical paintings with verses in the King James Bible. He links the light of the world with Psalm 119, verse 105. Thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path. The work of American Quaker painter Edward Hicks is saturated with biblical resonances. His preoccupation was the peaceable kingdom motif from Isaiah's prophecy. In fact, Hicks painted it as many as 100 times. We are not left to guess what English version of the Bible Hicks used. Sometimes the King James rendition of Isaiah 11, verse 6 appears on the frame of the paintings. The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. Literature. Of all the arts, literature is the easiest to link to the King James Bible. The subject is so large that it is hard to know where to begin. In regard to my book on the legacy of the King James Bible, a decision was reached right at the outset that half of the book would be devoted to literature, the literary qualities of the King James Version itself, and its influence on English and American authors. I devote a whole chapter to quoting literary authors and critics on their preference of the King James Version over all other English Bibles. To speak the truth, I've never seen a literary author endorse any Bible translation except the King James Version after its appearance, except for Catholic authors who sometimes choose the Reims translation for denominational reasons. To give you the flavor of the acclaim of literary people for the King James Version, I will dip into my chapter for specimen quotations and anecdotes. For the last decade of Samuel Taylor Coleridge's life, he had two books next to his bed, Martin Luther's Table Talk and the King James Bible. One of Coleridge's two King James Bibles that survive is heavily annotated by Coleridge. This is the context for Coleridge's famous statement that, quote, "The words of the Bible find me at greater depths of my being than all other books put together." Did you ever meet any book that went to your heart so often and so deeply? Here's a miscellany of brief endorsements of the King James Version. "Immeasurably superior to other translations," W.H. Auden. "All supreme," Eudora Welty. "Infinitely superior to other translations," Wallace Stegner. "Unmatchable," Christopher Fry. "Unquestionably the most beautiful book in the world," H.L. Mencken. "Stylistically superior to all other versions," John Chardy. "The greatest English text," Mark Shorer. The best quip comes from John Steinbeck, who, after seeing a movie based on the King James Bible, said, "Saw the movie, loved the book." While none of these endorsements proves the widespread presence of the King James Version in literature, they serve as a signpost that directs us to what we will find when we start our excursion through English and American literature. This morning is not the right time and place for me to document the prominence of the King James Bible in English and American literature. I will be content with two well-known quotations from literary scholars. A British scholar who wrote a book entitled The Bible as Literature wrote near the end of the book that the Bible, quote, "achieves as we read a strange authority and power as a work of literature. It becomes one with the Western tradition because it is its single greatest source." And Northrop Frye, the most prominent literary critic of the second half of the 20th century, wrote famously that the Bible is the major informing influence on literary symbolism. Once our view of the Bible comes into proper focus, a great mass of literary symbols begins to take on meaning. I come finally to the subject with which I said I would end, the influence of the King James Version on the English language. We can agree with David Daniel that the story of modern English as we know it starts with William Tyndale. The English language was in a distinctly impoverished state when Tyndale started to write, partly because the transition was underway from Middle English to Modern English. According to Daniel, Tyndale's great gift to the English language was the establishment of an English plain style, which Daniel claims is a register above conversational English. I do not have time to pursue a side skirmish here, so I will just state that my research does not confirm the common picture of a colloquial Tyndale as over against a polished King James Version. It is true that the King James translators had a sure instinct for betterment with regard to the inherited tradition of English Bible translation, but often this polishing resulted from the simplifying of Tyndale's version. In any case, the King James Version is what codified the Renaissance tradition of English Bible translation and then made it a constant for nearly four centuries, right to the present day. What the King James Version chiefly contributed, though, was a style and a standard of linguistic excellence. This is what lies behind the following comments by scholarly experts. One of the unintended functions of the King James Bible was to establish norms in written and spoken English. Should not the language of the Bible shape the language of the people? The growing acceptance of the King James Bible in shaping public and private religious discourse inevitably had its impact on the language as a whole. Alistair McGrath. What the King James Bible did was bring standard English into the forefront of people's attention. The general style of the English language has been so influenced by the Bible because of this public presence. David Crystal. The AV English Bible has to a marvelous extent shaped our speech, giving peculiar connotations to many words and sanctioning strange constructions. William Rosenau. for generation after generation, it gave the English-speaking world a template against which to measure their own utterances. Adam Nicholson. The most customary way by which to demonstrate the influence of the King James Bible on the English language is to list familiar idioms and proverbs that English-speaking people have owed to the KJV through the centuries. Any list of these sayings and expressions is necessarily selective. The following list will serve as well as any other. The land of the living, at their wit's end, heap coals of fire on his head. There is no new thing under the sun, the salt of the earth. A prophet is not without honor save in his own country. The signs of the times, in the twinkling of an eye. The root of the matter, fire and brimstone, a law unto themselves. Labor of love, old wives' fables, as a lamb to the slaughter, fell flat on his face. The Bible quotations that appear in Bartlett's famous quotations have been segregated out and published as a freestanding book entitled Bartlett's Bible Quotations. The book is over 200 pages long. The editor explains in the preface that all quotations come from the Authorized Version of the Bible, surely the most influential book ever published in the English language. The editor also correctly states that the famous quotations were introduced by the King James Bible, picked up in English vernacular, and entered popular imagination. What does a book like Bartlett's Bible Quotations show? It shows first that the King James Bible possesses the linguistic and stylistic qualities that enabled it to become the major influence on the development of the English language. Secondly, the Book of Bible Quotations shows again how pervasive the King James Version became in the English-speaking world. Thirdly, these quotations point to the status of the King James Bible as a guardian of linguistic standards. What was at stake when American pioneers traveled with the King James Bible and sometimes also Shakespeare's collected works in their wagons? What was signaled is that there was a standard of stylistic excellence that the pioneers wished to preserve amidst conditions that seemed to threaten vestiges of English culture. At every point for nearly four centuries, English-speaking people had a touchstone of what good written and oral communication sounded like. I believe that I myself lived through that experience. I grew up on a farm in central Iowa. My parents were immigrant children, and neither was educated beyond grade school. Growing up with the King James Version in this unsophisticated milieu, I unconsciously knew that the King James Bible represented something exalted and excellent. As a grade schooler, I did not understand every word or phrase in the King James Bible, but I remember experiencing that as desirable. Something big was going on, and I intuitively knew that someday I would have an entry into that expansiveness. I can't help contrasting that to modernizing and colloquial and dynamic equivalent Bibles, where the omnipresent norm is that of a sixth grade linguistic and intellectual level, as stated in the prefaces. It says to the Bible reading public, if you want to read the Bible, you need to leave your adult level of language comprehension at the door. This Bible is for people who operate at a sixth grade level. The well-attested irony is that the Bible reading public who has accepted a sixth grade Bible is more biblically illiterate with every passing year. Nor does that surprise me. In my view, a Bible that sounds like the daily newspaper elicits the degree of respect and attentiveness that the daily newspaper elicits. When the King James Bible was constantly before me in grade school and high school, I had something that called me above the prosaic, something that inspired me to reach higher than I had yet attained, not keep me permanently at a sixth grade level. As I conclude my remarks, it will have been evident that two themes have converged in my address. Ostensibly, I have traced the historical influence of the King James Version. But the King James Version would never have exerted that influence if it had not possessed the superior qualities that make it the greatest English Bible. So I want to conclude with a few tributes to the King James Version from voices that count. It grew to be a national possession and is in truth a national classic. No other book has so penetrated and permeated the hearts and speech of the English race. If everything else in our language should perish, it would alone suffice to show the whole extent of its beauty and power. And that was their triumph, a polished collation, a refinement of a century's translating, a book that became both clear and rich. It was the genius of the King James Version that it made the Word of God speak so directly to those who heard it that although people knew it was a translation, they could never really think of it as such. For never did a translation speak with such directness and life-giving power. Book titles include The Supreme Book of Mankind, The Book of Books, The Greatest English Classic. In popular Christian culture, the King James translation is seen to possess a dignity and authority that modern translations somehow fail to convey. The King James Bible retains its place as a literary and religious classic by which all others continue to be judged. On a historical scale, the sheer longevity of this version is a phenomenon without parallel. King James is still the best-selling book in the world. In the story of the earth we live on, its influence cannot be calculated. Finally, the Authorized Version is a miracle and a landmark. There is no corner of English life, no conversation that it has not adorned. Let me say in conclusion that if any of you have been disappointed by my focus on the King James Version, hoping for something more generic than a specific version of the Bible, you need to understand that for English readers of the Bible, there is no free-floating Bible emancipated from a specific version of that Bible. To claim that another version of the Bible might have produced the same effects that I have explored in this address is a purely speculative assertion. I am interested not in what might have been, but what we know did happen. Additionally, though, and as a summary of what I have asserted in my three addresses in this series, it is my belief that the only English Bible that could have captured people's imaginations the way the King James Version did was a translation that preserved the literary greatness of the Bible in its original form, and that was itself a literary masterpiece. Thank you.
Dr. Eichen has graciously agreed to answer questions, so we have a microphone here. If you have a question, please come forward and ask, and we'll spend a few minutes in question and answer.
Well, Mark is coming up. I found it so interesting that when I delivered a version of this at a retirement place, Windsor Park Manor in Wheaton, there were people in the audience who literally learned to read by way of the King James Bible.
And I can only use like a Young's Concordance. I can't use the new concordances because I don't know what the verses are. No, I was just wondering what you thought of the New King James Version. And did you suggest that you maybe took part in the ESV translation?
I did.
So are you wandering off on strange paths now?
Oh, no. Oh, well, no, I've always, you know, I have not used the King James Version as my main daily Bible beyond my college years. There are two modern translations that ride the literary coattails of the King James Version. One of them is the New King James Version, and the other is the English Standard Version. They come as close to the King James Version as modern scholarship and usage allow. I will say regarding the New King James, I did give, and obviously it came along long before the ESV, I gave it a chance to win me, and it didn't. Why not? This is a personal taste. It, to me, sounds like a makeover King James Version rather than as a genuinely modern translation. Now, the English Standard Version had a great advantage in that regard. It had the RSV of 1952 as an intermediary. That was our starting point, in fact. Everything was checked against the original, but nonetheless, we did have an existing translation that we did not change unless we had a good reason to. I think that was a big advantage. There was an intermediary, a kind of sieve through which the King James Version went. And then, after that intermediary, the English Standard Version. Having said that, I am very pleased when I see my students carrying the New King James Version as opposed to a dynamic equivalent or even more colloquial, easy reading Bible.
Hi there, I have two questions. First is, are you able to speak to like outside of the English Bible, and like when we look at other countries with their cultures, their languages, their history, and like their Bible translations?
No, I have no expertise in that at all. All I will note, just as a sidelight, is that the English Standard Version is a popular English version in diglot Bibles. I wonder if I've pronounced that correctly. In other words, the ESV in one column and an indigenous, the best indigenous language translation in the other. That's a common phenomenon, but I'm not expert at all in the other languages.
My second question is, I know that one of the big criticisms of the KJV is the textual issues and how they had discovered texts later that brought question some of the texts the KJV used. Can you speak to that?
Yes. The case against the King James Version, for me primarily, is the archaism of the language and usage. There is a second case against it, namely, the translation was not based on what today would be regarded as the best early text on which to base a translation. And then scholarship has uncovered a lot of nuances. That would not deter me in the least from using the King James Version. The number of occasions is really very limited and so well advertised that I don't think anyone's going to be misled by using the King James Version. But just for the record, yes, it used, the Textus Receptus, which is not currently in vogue and probably never will be again, as the best early manuscript tradition. In my view, there is a slight scholarly case against the King James Version and a very major case consisting of the archaism of the language and constructions.
This comes perhaps a little less from the realm of the church and more from the realm of education, but receiving some formal education in English, and I'm curious how it works at Wheaton and elsewhere. It was interesting for us, we had so little facility in broad swathes of the English tradition because no one ever interacted with the King James, and we came to Shakespeare and, you know, half the class, you know, we're struggling through it, we're trying to use videos, we're trying to use audio, we're trying to use all these sorts of things just to access those older portions of the English language. Is there a programmatic use of the King James as well from a childhood age to try to re-inculcate that? Did you ever try to do that in your English students to have them interact with the KJV, also to work with the language itself?
I personally do not. The question is, in the field of education, higher education, and literature particularly, is there an attempt to keep the King James alive? And not for me personally. I have from the beginning taught my Bible as literature from the RSV and then the ESV. Where there are Bible as literature courses in the secular university, the text used is very likely to be the King James Version. If that's being true to the literary tradition of it. I personally have never tried to keep the King James Version alive in my family, although my children used it when they were very young. I found interesting that even after my children were in situations where a modern translation was used, they found it much easier to memorize from the King James. Yes, I'm glad they came to that conclusion on their own, because it is definitely the case. Another virtue of the English Standard Version is that it retains the cadences and stylistic touches and aphoristic splendor of the King James Version wherever modern usage allows, so that I think rhythmically it is the best modern translation, the English Standard Version.
Thank you so much for your work on the ESV. I've really benefited from it. There was the original edition in 2001, and then there was the text update, just in small sections in 2007. I'm just thinking in terms of Bible memorization, I write scripture songs, that kind of thing, little changes. What are what's the future in terms of how often those tweaks happen and what plays into that?
Very conservative compared to other translations. It was the desire of Lane Dennis, president of Crossway, not to change the text for 25 years. Well, we keep getting these emails, the company does, from users. And then there were just things that, upon close scrutiny, we thought were wrong. So those changes, the translation was tweaked. It was also tweaked two years ago. I would predict no more changes for 20 years. That's what I would predict. And with some other modern translations, it's just amazing how the presence of that text in electronic form leads to just continuous changes. I mean, I can't can't even keep up with the changes with some of the translations. Well, ESV is not in that camp. Were you thwarted in one of your songs by a change in the text, or did you just notice it?
Yeah, it was like, what, you know, two words.
I can imagine how infuriating that was. All I can say is, I am very sorry.
Well, Dr. Reichen is available for a few minutes of conversation at the conclusion. We are concluding this now, and please again express your thanks to Dr. Reichen for these three fine lectures.